Hey everyone, thanks for tuning into Beyond the Veil. I'm your host, Raven Cook. Beyond the Veil is a podcast that combines African American history, poetry, and visual arts to get you thinking of the incredible ways that you, yes you, can make a difference in the world. So, without further ado, let's get into it. All right, everyone, welcome back to another week of Beyond the Veil. I'm really excited to talk to you this week about an incredible figure many of you know and are connected to in a real way, and that's Minister Malcolm X. Minister Malcolm is a personal hero of mine. When I was in college, I went to a predominantly white institution, and I took African American studies, and when I was there, Minister Malcolm was a voice that I leaned into very heavily to really retain a consciousness of my identity in a space that was always challenging me to assimilate into the culture of whiteness, and that I absolutely refused. Minister Malcolm. I sat at his feet and listened to his teachings and just really consumed his rhetoric so that I could maintain this sense of pride in my blackness and what it meant to be black in a space that was so enamored with whiteness, right? Like, it was rough. Every morning I wake up and I'd watch Spike Lee's Malcolm X, or I'd watch the documentary portion of the special features, and I just really it was like putting on armor in the morning to go out and be able to live the beauty that I saw as blackness unapologetically and without restraint, and do it understanding that a legacy, a foundation had been laid for me to do it, and people had fought and died for me too, and to be unapologetic about it. And so that's what I did. Minister Malcolm as a figure was also someone that I looked to really keep me anchored in my pursuit of understanding African-American history. He himself talked about how books were his alma mater, and really was an avid reader, from what history can tell us is what biographers talk to us about him. And I just found that really, really beautiful that he was a historical mind and used history as a tool to empower those in the present. So Minister Malcolm has always been a very powerful figure in my life, a figure that really anchors me, if you will. And so I'm excited to talk a little bit about his biography, talk about the concept of black nationalism within the context of the time that Minister Malcolm is presenting the idea and the ideology, maybe some of the origins of it, and then lean into some of the artworks that tie Minister Malcolm to the visual, right? Like, that take him and put him in this context of the visual arts and how artists are consuming these ideas that he's presenting while also dealing with his tragic assassination. It's we'll do that work and all the above, and let's get into it, right? So take a quick break, and then we'll dive into the biography of Minister Malcolm X. Hey everyone, we're back, and let's jump into the biography of Minister Malcolm. We won't go too in depth. We'll just kind of hit some of the highlights, because most people know the story of Minister Malcolm, and we really want to make sure we're giving adequate time to the discussion of artworks and other things. But I want to read this quick quote to you. It says, "People are always speculating why I am as I am. To understand that any person, his whole life from birth, must be reviewed. All our experiences fuse into our personality. Everything that ever happened to us is an ingredient." I think that an objective reader may see how in society, in the society to which I was exposed as a black youth here in America, for me to wind up in prison was really just about inevitable. And that was from the autobiography of Malcolm X, which was written in, which was released in 1965 after his assassination. Minister Malcolm was born Malcolm Little on May 19th, 1925 in Omaha, Nebraska. His father was a Baptist minister, and that's really critical to think about when thinking of the oratorical style of Minister Malcolm and kind of the way he exists as a speaker. I think it's really great that he has these roots in, you know, a profession that is so heavily reliant on public speaking. Earl Little was his father's name, and Earl Little and his wife were Garveyites. They were followers of the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey. Marcus Garvey plays a really critical role at the turn of the century as he is immigrating from Jamaica to New York, where he ends up starting this organization in about 1916, I want to say, which is called the Universal Negro Improvement Association. That organization sought to reiterate to black Americans the beauty that they held within them, and really to, you know, make the consciousness of like African peoples globally, really present this pan-African narrative, this global mobilization of African people towards pride and identity, that cultural integrity that we talked about in the previous episode with Kwame Ture, Stokely Carmichael. So Marcus Garvey kind of lays the foundation. Now, the difference, well, not even the difference, but Marcus Garvey's movement is really, really broad. It's really far reaching. And it is, there are even Garveyites in Arkansas, where I'm from. We have histories of that. Like, this is a really far-reaching movement that leans into this consciousness of uplift, which is really great. The flag, the red, black, and green flag, is developed through the Universal Negro Improvement Association and Marcus Garvey, and you really have this really beautiful development of consciousness through through Marcus Garvey, that Malcolm X's father is able to then to be a part of, right, and his mother. So Malcolm X kind of grows up with this acknowledgement of racial pride and identity and cultural integrity, if you will, and that's something that is really implanted into him at an early age. But he also deals with, through his text, this acknowledgement of colorism, even within the constructs of racial pride. He talked about how his father was very loving toward him and kind of challenging toward the other children. And he was lighter skinned based on his mother, right? His mother was a fair skinned woman, and so he inherited her lighter skinned complexion, and the father kind of gravitated toward that. So he deals with colorism in the early part of his autobiography that I think also is really interesting. Malcolm X's father also postured himself in this way of not accepting the racial, you know, constraints that were put upon black people, and still are today. But, you know, his father wasn't accepting that overt racism. He wasn't accepting of all of these different ideas. He as a Garveyite, you know, with that racial pride, there is a an acknowledgement of the system, but through the building of your own kind of this pushback on a system that, you know, is constantly challenging you and your identity. But Earl Little, Minister Earl Little, he ends up being murdered, right, because of his posture, right? Like, the way that he carried himself was an example to, I'm sure, a lot of African Americans in their space, to stand up for what, you know, is right. And we know throughout the context of American history, when a black man or woman stands up, there is pushback to that, whether it be, you know, financial or physical violence, you know, predicated or psychological predicated on that body. We know that there's constant pushback to black people asserting not only their humanity, but an equality and a power within themselves that's perceived as dangerous to the constructs of white supremacy. So, you know, with that being said, Malcolm X lost his father at a very young age, which was really, which affected his family financially, and really just as the patriarch died, you know, there was some challenges to the continuation of his family. His mother was admitted to a mental institution, and, he ended up living with his sister in Boston. And he dropped out of school and took on some menial jobs. There's a really powerful story in the autobiography behind the challenges to him educationally with a man named Mr. Ostrowski, which I find really interesting. And I encourage you to check out as well. But Minister Malcolm falls into, while living in Boston, he falls into this criminal life, gambling, prostitution, drug dealing, all of it. He was, really dealing with some challenging things. And then he goes to prison for 10 years. And while in prison, he learns about the Nation of Islam. And he begins to really think about his life and this kind of the totality of his journey, and really starting to recognize some of the challenges to his existence have come through this white supremacist structure. And he starts to recognize the best way for him and his people to advance is through this narrative of black separation, really, from these structures that exist. So he converts and he becomes a minister. In the narrative of art, there's an incredible photograph done by the legendary photographer Gordon Parks, who's one of my favorites. And he actually has this picture of Minister Malcolm, where Minister Malcolm is standing on the corner and is trying to get people to buy his newspaper, right? The Muhammad Speaks newspaper, because once Minister Malcolm joins the Nation of Islam, he goes into it full force. He's an organizer, he's a mobilizer, he's an activist, he's moving constantly forward. Gordon Parks takes this really powerful picture, and it's one of my favorites because in that picture, you see people just walking by, but not really recognizing who this man is and who he would be and the fact that he would become a legend. They're just walking by him. And it's really something to be said about how we see greatness and sometimes we just ignore it. It's a beautiful picture. But to continue on, Minister Malcolm starts to speak and become an active minister and gets his own church and starts to really mobilize on behalf of the Nation of Islam. His viewpoints were overt, unapologetic. He saw white people as really a problem to the advancement of black people, right? Really was challenged by it and pushed in a way to discuss it that was very, very for black people was scary to some, and for white people definitely was threatening. But I think Minister Malcolm's anger was so important to the verbalizing of black frustrations with the systems that they lived in. I think he as a figure is a powerful force in history, American history, and I think his legacy should never ever be forgotten, because he does challenge those systems, because he does make people uncomfortable, because that discomfort does push people to a radical change and restructuring the things that they're thinking about. I think that's so incredibly important. So Minister Malcolm will forever be a titan, in my opinion, for that. He goes on to become one of the more powerful ministers in the Nation of Islam, and developing these structures within the Black Muslim experience that are really grounded in this consciousness of Black identity, but also uplift, racial uplift. The thing that puts him kind of at the forefront of American consciousness is this documentary that's done in the 60s called The Hate That Hate Produced. And it put Minister Malcolm in a way that he was seen by a broader audience and began to really lean into some of his voice. The thing that throws him into a different movement, or a different way of moving as a leader and a speaker, is when he speaks out against, well, not even really against, but he acknowledges Kennedy's assassination as President Kennedy, John F. Kennedy's assassination as chickens coming home to roost in the early 1960s, which was seen to the Nation of Islam in direct violation. And they silenced him for a period before the organization and Minister Malcolm finally split ways. Minister Malcolm would go on to seek to really get support from Black leaders, Black world leaders, African world leaders, to mobilize Black people, but also to really have a global bodies indict the U.S. on to indict them on this narrative of racial violence, and really acknowledge some of the systems that have been created to suppress Black advancement. And so really to create language that shows the human rights violations against Black bodies, with countries that are dealing with the colonial and globalization narratives of American force, right, was something that he worked toward. He travels and does the Hajj to Mecca, and he, you know, consumes new ideas about white people and white supremacy, kind of differentiating between the two. You see him start to move a little differently, but he also has a lot of challenges with Black leadership through his work as a speaker, challenging some of the perspectives of nonviolence and things like that. So Minister Malcolm and Dr. King are not really in step with one another, as most people know. But as I mentioned in the previous notations, I think it's really important to be conscious of the fact that they move differently. They're living in different regions. When Dr. King goes to some of these urban areas that Minister Malcolm had lived in before his assassination and had mobilized in, Dr. King is unable to really facilitate radical change in those spaces. The southern and northern institutions are totally different, but both, you know, really suppressive to Black people at that time, and still at times today. But it's important to understand that Minister Malcolm, near the end of his life, goes to Selma and speaks to people and really seeks to create some consciousness amongst Black leaders that we're all looking to advance the human quality of Blackness in America, but we're just doing it in different ways. And Of course, sadly, we know that Minister Malcolm is assassinated in 1965, and that assassination was very violent. But Minister Malcolm, as a figure, is put into a way that his voice continues to be with us day after day after day. And I think that's also really important. I wanted to do an episode on Malcolm X because I think he's so critically important to Black people today. I think his legacy, his voice, I think he's just really powerful. I really feel like the world lost a giant when he was assassinated, but I feel like we still have his writings, his speeches, and things like that that anchor us every day. I want to lean into one of my favorite speeches of his, and that's a message to the grassroots. And so we'll dive into that in just a second. So we'll take a quick break and then dive into a message to the grassroots. Okay, so I wanted to talk a little bit about one of my favorite speeches of Minister Malcolm's. It's called Message to the Grassroots. I read this speech when I was actually the summer of the murder of the Charleston Nine. And I was so angry and I was so frustrated, and I wanted to do something to help people, and I wanted to be involved, and I wanted to do something. And I looked to the voices of Minister Malcolm and Stokely Carmichael or Kwame Ture and so many others, and I was just trying to figure out what was I going to do. Angela Davis, all these really powerful figures. And so I stumbled upon this speech, and I'm going to read sections of it. But it's delivered November 10th, 1963, and you can find a more recent copy. The text I'm reading from is the Portable Malcolm X Reader, which was written by Manning Marable. Manning Marable, the late historian, the late great historian, also wrote a really powerful biography on Minister Malcolm. It's called A Life of Reinvention. I think that's the title. Manning Marable wrote a really comprehensive text. What I didn't know about Minister Malcolm's, the work of being a biographer for Minister Malcolm is the incredible things that you had to go through to get it done. This book, The Portable Malcolm X Reader, talks about a lot of challenges that historians and biographers had to overcome to be able to get the speeches, get the information on Minister Malcolm. So it's really, really, it's really, really important. The writings of his, it's really important to have them, put into text so we can be able to think about his legacy beyond the times that we, beyond his time and into ours, so we can use him to help, promote ourselves and inspire us to push toward radical change. So I'm going to read a couple of sections of this. This speech is really interesting to me because he's speaking to this group that is because he's speaking to this group that is mobilizing, right? The grassroots, when we think of grassroots mobilizations, we think about getting involved with the people, getting on the ground, and really being active in radical change. And I love this particular line. He says, of all our studies, history is best qualified to reward our research. And when you see you've got problems, all you have to do is examine the historic method used all over the world by others who have similar problems to yours, or rather, who have problems similar to yours. Once you see how they got theirs straight, then you know how you can get yours straight. So he's talking in this space about how to use history as a tool to fix some of the challenges that you see, to look at history, not just your cultural history, but others, to be able to understand how to mobilize and how to use certain things that other groups might have used, and tactics and strategies to be able to, seek liberation for yourself. He goes on in saying, there's been a revolution, a black revolution going on in Africa. In Kenya, the Mau Mau were revolutionary. They were the ones who brought the word Uhuru to the fore. The Mau Mau, they were revolutionary. They believed in scorched earth. They knocked everything aside that got in their way. And their revolution was based on land, a desire for land. In Algeria, the northern part of Africa, a revolution took place. The Algerians were revolutionists. They wanted land. France offered to let them be integrated into France, and they told France to hell with France. They wanted some land, not some France, and they engaged in bloody battle. So, you know, in this passage, he's dealing with this concept of revolution, but more so land. When black people were when the millions of black people were freed from the institution of slavery, there was a meeting between, and this is in 1865, there's a meeting between William Tecumseh Sherman and Edwin Stanton, who was the Secretary of War for Lincoln. They go to Georgia, I believe, and they meet with about 20 black leaders, particularly pastors. And one man whose name was Garrison Frazier, Pastor Garrison Frazier, speaks on behalf of this group. And when William Tecumseh Sherman asks, you know, what do we do to help black people, you know, after the Civil War, he talks about land, right? He talks about, give us land and we'll do what we need to do. We'll stay out of the way. We're not trying to be a part of whatever. We'll fight when we need to protect our land, but give us our own space. And then you've got the development of Special Field Order 15, or 40 acres and a mule. So this concept of land and this idea of revolution are so intimately tied to the narratives and the speeches and the voices of black oratory throughout the centuries, that Malcolm X is really just anchored in that tradition. But then you go on and you continue in his speech, and he talks about the Negro Revolution, as he writes, or speaks rather. He says, the only kind of revolution that is nonviolent is the Negro Revolution. The only revolution in which the goal is loving your enemy is the Negro Revolution. It's the only revolution in which the goal is a desegregated lunch counter, a desegregated theater, a desegregated park, and a desegregated public toilet. You can sit down next to white folks on the toilet. That's no revolution. Revolution is based on land. Land is the basis of all independence. Land is the basis of freedom, justice, and equality. The white man knows what a revolution is. He knows that the black revolution is worldwide in scope and in nature. The black revolution is sweeping Asia, is sweeping Africa, and rearing its head in Latin America. The Cuban revolution, that revolution, they overturned the system. Revolution is in Asia. Revolution is in Africa. The white man is screaming because he sees revolution in Latin America. How do you think he'll react to you when you learn what real revolution is? You don't know what a revolution is. If you did, you wouldn't use that word. Revolution is bloody. Revolution is hostile. Revolution knows no compromise, and revolution overturns and destroys everything that gets in its way. And you sitting around here like a knot on the wall saying, I'm going to love these folks no matter how much they hate me. No, you need a revolution. Whoever heard of a revolution where they lock arms, as Brother Cleage was pointing out, beautifully singing, "We Shall Overcome." You don't do that in revolution. You don't do any singing, because you're too busy swinging. It's based on land. A revolutionary wants land so he can set up his own nation, an independent nation. These Negroes aren't asking for any nation. They're asking to crawl back on the plantation. When you want a nation, that's called nationalism. When the white man became involved in a revolution in this country against England, what was it for? He wanted this land so he could set up another white nation. That's white nationalism. The American Revolution was white nationalism. The French Revolution was white nationalism. The Russian Revolution too, yes, it was white nationalism. You don't think so? Why do you think Khrushchev and Mao can't get their heads together? White nationalism. All the revolutions that are going on in Asia and Africa today are based on what? Black nationalism. A revolutionary is a black nationalist. He wants a nation. So much to point out in that section, right? First, okay, so let's go back a little bit and we'll talk about it. So this idea of the Negro Revolution, right? This idea of the black revolution. So when you hear about this concept of revolution and this narrative of like what revolution means to black people in the States, you see them talking about a desegregated theater, a park, or whatever, toilet. You can sit down next to white folks on the toilet. That's no revolution. So Minister Malcolm is positioning his narrative in a framework of saying like revolution is about this. And to get this, it requires that, right? To get this land, it requires violence. Because people are not going to give up land just willingly, right? Like, and then he starts to break down some of the structures, right? Break down some of the times historically that we've seen it. So he ties the top of his speech, the idea of history and what it can do and how it can teach us, to the concept of what's later seen as like this acknowledgement of how history has presented, you know, people who are revolutionary by the acquisition of land through force. So he ties that together so eloquently. He does such an incredible job doing that work. But then he goes into this concept of the idea, like breaking down this construct of nationalism and how land gives you this nationalist narrative, this nation that's built gives you this nationalist sentiment. So he goes beyond that construct of like, okay, it's just land, like like land is almost tied to this identity. And it's really, really interesting how he does that work. But then he talks about the violence of revolution and how when you talk about revolution, it is something that is shifting and changing the constructs that people are existing in, or rather the spaces, right, that people are living in. Revolution is a radical in its change. And he talks about revolution so frivolously, but when we think about revolution in the context of history, it is something that is violent. It's termed with you know, it's labeled for these violent uprisings and things that happen when people are trying to overthrow these very oppressive systems that exist. So he understands that, and he speaks on it and to this group, right, that is mobilizing on a grassroots level. Then he goes into another really important section that I want to lean into. He says, to understand this, and he's talking about revolution and the love for revolution and black nationalism. He says, to understand that concept, to understand this, you have to go back to what the young brother here referred to as the house Negro and the field Negro back during slavery. So here, once again, we have him intersecting history with the contemporary narratives of like what is happening within the constructs of society. Once again, reiterating my earlier point about how he's an incredible historian in the development of African-American history and culture and context. So he says, there are two kinds of slaves, the house Negro and the field Negro. The house Negroes, they lived in the house with the master. They dressed pretty good. They ate good because they ate his food where he left. They lived in the attic or the basement, but still they lived near the master, and they loved the master more than the master loved himself. They would give their life to save the master's house quicker than the master would. If the master said, "We got a good house here," the house Negro would say, "Yeah, we got a good house here." Whenever the master said "we," he said "we." That's how you can tell a house Negro. If the master's house caught on fire, the house Negro would fight harder to put the blaze out than the master would. If the master got sick, the house Negro would say, "What's the matter, boss? We sick? We sick." he identified himself with his master more than the master identified with himself. And if you came to the house Negro and said, let's run away, escape, let's separate, the house Negro would look at you and say, man, are you crazy? What you mean separate? Where is there better house than this? Where can we, where can I wear better clothes than this? Where can I eat better food than this? That was the house Negro. In those days, you know, and then he goes on talking about like the distinctions in the modern day and today, and he talks about the modernity of thinking within the framework of the house Negro, saying he wants to live near him. He'll pay three times as much as the house is worth just to live near his master, and then brag about it. I'm the only Negro out here. I'm the only one on my job. I'm the only one in this school. You're nothing but a house Negro. And if someone comes to you right now and says, let's separate, you say the same thing that a house Negro would say on the plantation. What you mean separate? From America? This good white man. Where would you go? Where are you going to go to get a better job than here? I mean, this is what you say. I ain't left nothing in Africa. That's what you say. Why you left your mind in Africa? Like, it's really profound the way that he leans into this consciousness. Like, it's whenever I read this speech, and I have several notes in this book, but whenever I read this speech, it's really something to me to think about my relationship to what he's saying. You know, and trying to always be conscious of the way that I exist in the world is very, very important. But I want to lean into a section that's even more like leaned into exactly some of the people that he's challenged by, if you will. And he talks about Dr. King. He says, when Martin Luther King failed to desegregate Albany, Georgia, the civil rights struggle in America reached its low point. King became bankrupt almost as a leader. The Southern Christian Leadership Conference was in financial trouble, and it was in trouble, period, with all the people when they failed to desegregate Albany, Georgia. Other Negro civil rights leaders of so-called national stature became fallen idols. As they became fallen idols, began to lose their prestige and influence. Local Negro leaders began to stir up the masses. He keeps going and he talks about as soon as King failed in Birmingham, Negroes took to the streets. King went out to California to a big rally and raised I don't know how many thousands of dollars. He came to Detroit and had a march and raised some more thousands of dollars. And recall right after that, Roy Wilkins attacked King. He accused King and CORE, or the Congress of Racial Equality, which we talked about last week, of starting trouble everywhere and then making the NAACP get them out of jail and spend lots of money. They accused King and CORE of raising all the money and not paying it back. This happened. I've got documented evidence in the newspaper. And so he's talking about some of these conflicts within the civil rights struggle, right? The Southern freedom struggle. And I think it's really important to also consider that a lot of black thinkers and artists are, you know, they see King as a force and they respect him, but they listen to Minister Malcolm in an important way as well, and they acknowledge what he's saying about revolution and land and the acquisition of land and building up their own communities as really important as well. He goes on and talks about several other things. I definitely encourage you to read this speech. I'm not going to read all of it, but what I will say is this speech is really important when you think about some of the people that Minister Malcolm is discussing, but also when you think about the concept of history and land and the acquisition of land and radical change and revolution. And I think it's really important for us in a day-to-day day-to-day context to think about the language that we use in trying to mobilize radical change. And if we want to be revolutionaries in America and people who go about deconstructing systems of oppression, that we understand that that won't be something that happens passively, right? Like, it's going to be something that people will respond to and something people will feel. And we've seen that not only with the language from Minister Malcolm, but we see that with the literal actions that were put up, you know, that civil rights organizers had to deal with, you know, through the times that the Southern Freedom the movement was happening. So it's really important to think about those things, be conscious of them, and really lean into more of the writings of Minister Malcolm. We're going to take another break and then jump into an artist and artwork that I feel is really critical in thinking about the kind of the aftermath of the assassination of Minister Malcolm, but also the legacy that he holds and continues to hold in African American history. So we'll take another quick break and then we'll get back into thinking about Minister Malcolm from an artistic lens. Okay, so as we're thinking about Minister Malcolm, I think probably the way that's been most impactful for me to learn a new way of hearing and thinking of the legacy of Minister Malcolm is the arts. African American artists at the time of the Civil Rights Movement or the Southern Freedom Movement are creating some really powerful works of art, especially in the context of abstraction. And let's just kind of go over quickly like what abstraction is. So when I get students, like I work, of course, in the arts, like in museum spaces. And when I ask students like, hey, you know, what do you think? What is abstraction? Like, what does that mean? Students will be like, they'll say stuff like, well, Miss Raven, it is just a whole bunch of stuff that doesn't make any sense. And it's just like all over the place. It's just random and crazy all over. And I always kind of giggle and I say, okay, well, what are some things that make up all that random stuff? And they'll say, you know, lines, and, you know, they'll just throw a whole bunch of paint on there. And I'll say, oh, okay, does the paint have colors? And they'll say, oh, yeah, lots of colors, but you don't ever know, like, why they're there. You're like, oh, okay. And then, you know, they'll continue, and I'll say, well, what else? What else do you need to make some of these crazy paintings? And they'll talk about sometimes there's some shapes in there, sometimes there's people in there, but you don't really know what's going on. And so from that, you know, I'll lean into this concept of like abstraction being something that is not necessarily something we can always clearly, you know, contextualize. It's not something we can take our history and our kind of consciousness of like, that is a man and that is a woman and that is a dog and that is a cat or whatever, and like put it onto the painting. It requires us to have this sense that we don't know what's going on, and like finding comfort in the uncomfortable. But a lot of times I find abstraction to be something where you do know what's going on in a way, and to be able to interpret it in a way that, you know, reaches you, or have conversation about it in a way that is, you know, transforming, is really interesting. A lot of ways that we can look towards interpretation of the arts are in knowing the context, like the history of the artist, but also the subject matter that they may be discussing. A lot of abstract artists, specifically African American abstract artists, are seeking to really throw off this label of like black at the time. They just want to be artists. They don't want to exist in the identities of both, like these intersecting identities of both race race and, you know, their occupation, because they see limitations, right, in how they're able to mobilize financially, economically in, you know, the art world when they have those restrictions. They have certain, you know, narratives about how they should create put on them. And if you're a creative, it's very, you know, suppressing if you only get to create in one way. So this real desire to throw off some of that is really important. When I was, when I was about 27, which wasn't too long ago, it was just a year ago. Anyway, last year, I had the opportunity to see the show, and it came to the United States from London, and it was so magnificent. And I got there a little earlier. I'm going to tell you why it's so important to me. I got there a little early, and, you know, this was a predominantly, you know, white museum, and, you know, they were seeking to do something really radical and new and different and to tell an important story. So, you know, the show came to the U.S. and it was at this museum. So I got there a little early, and these videos were playing of like Stokely Carmichael and Angela Davis and Dr. King. And it was just so amazing, right? It was so beautiful. And so I walked in, and there was this piece that I was really looking forward to seeing, because I felt like the artist, really like his spirit like connected with me in such a real way while I was hearing about this incredible show that was coming to that museum. And I walked in and I was looking for that piece because I knew it wouldn't let me down. And I got to it, and it certainly did not. It was this huge black triangle, and I remember getting to it and just being breathless for a second. It was just like, oh, so magnificent. Like, it was one of the happiest moments of my whole life to see a work of art that was so rich and so intimately connected to African American history in a way that I could just teach circles around it, right? So I walked up to it, and I noticed these like hints of color, right? Red and green. And then I noticed all these beautiful lines, like, you know, really deep on the canvas, but they weren't like overt, they weren't like aggressive or in your face. It was layered triangles. There were three triangles that existed on this one huge triangle, but then the second triangle had these like really beautiful lines, and this just hint of red and hint of green, not too, you know, ostentatious. It was just right to where you could see it and you can enter, you know, it could connect to you, but not, you know, it wasn't aggressive. And I remember just bursting into tears. It was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen in my whole life. I was so moved by it. The whole show was magnificent because it focused on the voices of black people, and I'd never seen art with black bodies in fine art spaces, and watching, you know, white people consume, you know, beautiful black art, right, with just perfect composition and color and line and shape. And I can't describe it to you. It was so beautiful. But this work of art was called Homage to Malcolm, and it was by an artist named Jack Whitten. And a couple of days before the show opened, Jack Whitten passed away. And it hit me so hard that when I saw the work of art, I just burst into tears. Because as I mentioned, the artwork seemed to be so spiritually tied to me. Like, I felt like the artist, he worked in such a way that I understood, and I felt, and I could connect with. Even though I'm a black woman, I was really moved by the materials that he used and his practice and the way that he was so incredibly thoughtful about the way that he dealt with the grief of losing Minister Malcolm. And it was magnificent. But a little bit about Jack Whitten. Jack Whitten was born in Bessemer, Alabama in 1939. And he was the son of a co-worker and a seamstress. And he initially wanted to be in the sciences. He wanted to be a doctor. But he went into a different way, and he leaned into this concept of art, which is not, uncommon for a lot of artists to have had some type of like background in the sciences, or especially abstract artists like Fred Eversley, who does a lot with parabolas and more materials that create these lenses that are really beautiful. But Jack Whitten transferred from Tuskegee Institute, where he was studying to become a doctor, to Southern University in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Ironically, leaning into the idea of the message of the grassroots, he gets involved with Dr. King's civil rights movement, but he couldn't shake the frustration and the anger that he felt about nonviolence, right? Like the sense of like I can't, engage in like fighting back, which is what I feel like in my human existence I should be able to do, right? So he moves to New York and he starts to he goes to a Cooper Union and he graduates with a BA in 1964, a Bachelor's of Fine Arts, a BFA, excuse me. He leans into the voice of Minister Malcolm in a way that you can see in his art, which I think is really incredible. A book recently came out called Jack Whitten: Notes from the Woodshed, and when I first saw it, the first page of it. It kind of scared me. It said, "These notes represent my private log. Please do not read. Not meant for publishing. Jack Whitten." And so I remember I went to the librarian and I was like, "Why, I don't think I should be reading this, but I really want it." And it was funny. But then she went into telling me about how the writer did, end up getting his permissions to publish the text. But I just saw that as like a don't go there. But when I opened the book and I started reading, I was really moved by it. There's a day he writes a lot of like notes, a lot of he was a military man also, and so he wrote a lot in like short script, like he wrote a lot in like these little notes. Which I also thought was interesting. And one of them, one of the days, he writes these like objectives, and he says, the first one is remove the European significance of touch in paintings. That was one. Two, insist upon the painting's African heritage. Three, remove the notion of me. Four, stop relying upon ghosts to do the painting. Five, don't wallow in the past and with God's help avoid romantic nationalism. Six, the painting is not an illustration of anything. Seven, eliminate that which qualifies as narrative. Eight, allow the paint as materials to take care of the black thing. Nine, don't succumb to populist aesthetics. 10, learn to understand existence as being political. 10, or that was 10. 11, accept the fact that there are multiple dimensions in time. 12, don't ever beg for anything. 13, accept God's guidance and forever be free. And I'll let the 14th one be. It says, you know what? I'll keep going. It says, 14 is learn to live by the philosophy of jazz, which I actually do. I love jazz. Anyway, 15, only fools want to be famous. Avoid it at all costs. 16. The painting should never exist as a square, rectangle, triangle, or anything other Lucian figure. 17. Abstract expressionist gesture is a no-no. 18. The figure in present-day painting is obsolete until I reintroduce it as a modern concept. And I could keep going. These are really profound. They're about 32, so I won't do all of them, but we'll talk a little bit about his experimentation. So this biography that I found talks about how he experiments with acrylic polymers, or he rather experimented with acrylic polymers and used a number of different principles to be able to convey some ideas. So he would create in color and use a broad range of materials: iron oxide, dry pigments, crushed mylar, ash bone, and even blood. And then it talked about like the colors and things like that, and his experiences with the civil rights movement, Vietnam, and the politics of the 1960s. One of the sections in the book talks about the night of the Cuban Missile Crisis and how everyone, excuse me, is thinking about the mortality, you know, their human mortality and violence and war, and how artists are, you know, dealing with that. And I think that leans into the idea of this work of art. The piece Homage to Malcolm was done in 1970, and it's about 5 years after the assassination of Minister Malcolm. And as I mentioned, the triangle was incredibly large. It took up like a whole wall. It's huge. But it's so, it was so powerful and central to, it felt like it was one of the heartbeats of the show. You'll be walking through and you just hear these like pulses of like blackness, and then you get to these major moments and you just feel these like thumps, like ba-boom. Like it was just so incredible. And I remember standing in front of it and seeing those lines and learning that the lines had been done with an Afro-pick comb. So he took the comb and he just lined these very like intimate, intricate lines that were all connecting, right? Like in all just like all over the place, but still had like intention and purpose. You saw them in the canvas. And I want to use that as a way to kind of like close into thinking about the quote that we started with when Minister Malcolm was talking about, you know, these connected things in life. And I think Jack Whitten did such a beautiful job of like conveying the heartbreak of losing Minister Malcolm as a figure. You know, we you know, he wasn't like a blood relative of us, but his voice was so, and always will be, so incredibly impactful in the world of Black America. And the way it was violently taken from us is crazy, but the lines on that beautiful canvas, this rich dark canvas, that was just beautifully black, right? It was tall and it was black, and it had these hints of red and green and just like a dash of blue almost. It was so beautiful. But those lines were so magnificent to me in the way that they came about through the use of the Afro pick. And it reminded me a lot of that quote where Minister Malcolm says, "To understand that any person, his whole life from birth, must be reviewed. All our experiences fuse into our personality. Everything that happened to us is an ingredient." I think that echoed so beautifully into the way that Jack Whitten creates these this visual piece. Incredible artist, incredible figure in Minister Malcolm X. And I just really wanted to do a show to honor both Minister Malcolm and Jack Whitten, because they're both very iconic figures in my practice as a Black historian and also a Black arts educator, museum educator. And I hope that you enjoyed the show. I'm going to encourage you to tune in next week, where we'll talk about an incredible woman. And it'll also be my birthday when that show is published. So it's going to be great to talk about a woman who, her birthday isn't on my birthday, but it's very, very close. So we'll get a chance to talk about her and some of her incredible work, and then acknowledge a work of art that also does this really important work of thinking about a very dark time in African American history and the way that artists are using their clay and canvas to deal with it, while African American political and his educators and activists are thinking about much the same. Thank you once again for listening. This has been another episode of Beyond the Veil, and I'm so excited. I hope you all enjoyed it. And keep learning, keep growing, keep listening to the words of Minister Malcolm, and keep being the change that we really, really need to see in this world and be a part of, and really be someone that is committed to a life of radical change and justice by any means necessary. All right, peace. Beyond the Veil has been brought to you by Foundation's Black History Educational Programming. With a vision that strives to educate all people on the incredible legacy of Black Americans in the United States and around the globe, and a mission to provide quality, creative, and engaging educational programming that utilizes varied types of artistic expression, Beyond the Veil comes to you every Saturday and hopes to encourage you to not only look at art in a new way, but also learn African American history every single day. To learn more about Foundations, follow us on Facebook at Foundations Black History Education or on Instagram at Foundations RC. Once again, thank you for listening. Please share this program and continue to learn the incredible legacy of Black Americans in the United States and around the globe. This has been Beyond the Veil. Thanks for listening.